time for a deep dive into the one issue that matters most in a capitalist democracy, money. This is Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money, a joint production of the Maggie Dawn Show and the Patriotic Millionaires.
We are doing Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money, and it's always a pleasure to be joined by incredibly smart women who have so much to say on these super important topics. This week, we've been talking about global power and money and how wealth influences and controls not just institutions in the United States, but global institutions and our global economic system. We've heard from Oxfam's Nabil Ahmed about how concentrated wealth has really become the standard across the world and how many corporations are owned by billionaires and how global institutions are in many ways being manipulated and controlled by billionaires to serve their own interests. And we talked yesterday with Bob Lord and Scott Ellis about how here, the institution of the Supreme Court of the United States is being, by many accounts, influenced, perhaps at best and at worst, controlled by the billionaire class. And today, I'm so happy to be joined by one of the world's foremost experts on international economics and globalization, something that I, as an economist, have always been interested in, and certainly as a lawyer and having worked abroad, has been an interest close to my heart. We're going to talk about what all of this means in a global geopolitical context. While that sounds obtuse, it's really not. And it has very, very concrete impacts on the quality of life, not just for the middle class and working people in this country, but across the world. Her name is Jyoti Ghosh. She taught economics at Nehru University in New Delhi. She's currently an econ professor at UMass Amherst. And in 2021, the United Nations named her to be on the High-Level Advisory Board on Economic and Social Affairs. And as a fellow nerd, I will say this. One of the most impressive things on your resume is that you are the Executive Secretary of International Development Economics Associates, an international network of heterodox development economists. I know those are, that is an elite group, if I can say so. Welcome, Jyoti. Thank you so much for making time for us today.
Thank you, Maggie. It's a real pleasure.
You have spent basically your entire life studying exactly how businesses and billionaires accumulate and expand market power and then use it to consolidate within industries, whether vertically or horizontally, and use that consolidated power to influence politics. Again, how does that play out both here in the United States and around the world? And what results from this pattern of again, accelerating wealth, consolidation, and the exercise of political power as a result?
You know, Maggie, I think in the US, you're already seeing the results. You're seeing how most ordinary people feel more insecure, more fragile, more resentful, and how they then tend to blame it on others who are like them, really. Yes. On migrant workers or on minorities. Exactly that same thing is playing out in the rest of the world as well. And it's, in fact, it's actually worse. Because in the US, it plays out in terms of more insecurity, more unhappiness, more frustration and resentment. Maybe you don't get a job. Maybe you don't get the kind of job you would like. Maybe you can't make ends meet exactly as you used to. But in many parts of the world, we are talking about absolute hunger. We're talking about people who are reduced to starvation because of these big processes that are controlled essentially by very large multinational corporations and very rich people who, as you mentioned, can also influence policies.
Mm. So critical. And we're going to dive into some of those particular results that we see in the developing world. But extreme inequality isn't just a fairness issue. It can actually drag down entire economies. Developing economies, of course, more susceptible. And by extension, part of what you study, Jyoti, is that when economies start to get dragged down and you see this incredible wealth concentration, the likelihood of dictatorships, of authoritarian regimes, of course, goes up. Explain this interaction, how this destabilization results from this extreme inequality.
So extreme inequality has all kinds of manifestations. As I said, it leads to more and more people feeling unsettled, insecure, unhappy, and of course worried about their basic material life and existence. But it also creates a power group that can continue to manipulate markets, that can affect government regulations and laws and policies in their favor, that can change fiscal policies, taxation policies, spending policies in their favor, and basically make it worse and worse. And so it's not a surprise that in that whole period, the last 10 years, everybody has been talking much more about inequality, and it's been getting worse every time. Every year it is worse than the previous year, because all of these powerful people are economically powerful, so they can influence not just the politics, but the policies that will keep them entrenched in power. That means that as insecurities among ordinary people rise, they're looking for some solution. And so you tend to go for strong men, really. And I have to say they're mostly men, strong men who declare that, you know, we can change all of this for you. We understand your frustration. They will present themselves as outsiders when they're essentially insider, and they're totally in with the crony large capitalists, but they will present themselves in a way that ordinary people just fall for. And we're seeing this across the world, of course, in the US, but in so many other countries.
Yeah, there is a cycle of exploitation that you seem to describe and that we're seeing replicated, again, at different levels of consequence to working people and frankly, poor folks. But the cycle of exploitation that really relies and then promotes from those that control economic power at a vast scale, having this influence on policies and politics and institutions. And many of these leaders that are cropping up, not just in the United States, but as you say, Jyoti, across the world, really—
My own country, yes, in India.
Yes. They appeal to this nativist, isolationist sentiment because people are feeling, correctly so, their intuition is telling them, I'm being exploited. Yeah. This is not fair. Yeah. Can you give us a couple of examples, a couple of industries where this shows up very concretely?
Well, you don't have to look very far back. Just look in the last 3 years at what has happened to global food prices and the associated hunger. So I don't know how many people listening know about the Sustainable Development Goals, which are these big goals that the whole international community, the UN, agreed on in 2015. One of them, the first one, was supposed to be the easiest one, which is get rid of hunger. And it's kind of obvious, right? There is enough food to feed the whole planet and more. We really don't have to have hungry people. Eliminate hunger. Everybody thought this is the easy one. We've got worse. It's actually increased. The number of hungry people has gone up by more than 150 million since the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic. And that need not have happened. That is essentially a result of exactly the processes that we were talking about. So what happened exactly? First, you had this pandemic, and that played out very unequally between rich and poor countries. Because the rich countries, yes, things closed down and you had to stop doing things. But, you know, there was a lot of social protection. In the US, everybody got checks in the mail. In many other countries, there was lots more public spending to balance out the fact that you couldn't go out and earn your living. In most poor and low middle and middle income countries, you didn't get that. You didn't get anything to compensate for your inability to earn your own livelihood. And so you got really lots of people facing extreme hunger in that situation because governments either could not or would not provide the minimum social protection you need to do. Okay, so you have the pandemic. Maybe after that there will be recovery, you think? No, because after that, what do we get? We get the Ukraine war, right? So Russia first threatens to and then does invade Ukraine. And remember, Russia is a big wheat exporter. So is Ukraine, a big wheat exporter. So everyone says, oh my God, now the wheat market will be affected. And true, the global wheat prices shoot up. They like double in 6 months, okay? In fact, all food prices go up. And everyone says, oh, it's because of the war and it's because these two big countries that are exporting wheat can't export it anymore. That's not true. It turns out global supply was not affected. Global supply was the same. In fact, it increased over that period. So what on earth was going on? It was big agribusinesses. there are four big agri businesses that control 80% of the global food market, food grain market, okay? And if you add a fifth smaller one, it's 90%, okay? They control this market and they just raise their prices. And nobody questioned it because they said, oh, sure, it's because of the war. The media plays a big role in this as well, right? The media kept telling us that, oh, yeah, Russia's an exporter, Ukraine's an exporter, so it's all really terrible about grain exports. So they were allowed to dramatically increase prices, which affects not just people in the US and in Europe, but it really affects people in poor countries, okay? Now, remember, in addition to that, you have the agribusinesses making profits, but you also have these financial companies speculating in commodity futures markets. So you got a combination, like a really big group getting together to raise these prices.
We're going to have to take a couple messages, but there are these intersections between the financial industry and some of what happens with currencies, as well as these massive multinational corporations that control our food supply. We doubled down on that in the United States. We had egg manufacturers and other manufacturers artificially reducing supply to keep these prices artificially inflated. Jyoti, I have a name for it. I call it pandemic profiteering. There was no reason to keep the prices that high, and yet we stayed there. Folks, my very special guest, an international expert on economics and globalism, her name is Jyoti Ghosh. She is currently a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. She's taught in New Delhi, and she has been named in the past by the United Nations in 2021 to the High-Level Advisory Board on Economic and Social Affairs. Today we have a very special guest. Her name is Jyoti Ghosh. She taught economics at the University of Nehru at New Delhi. She is currently a professor of economics at UMass Amherst. She is the executive secretary of International Development Economics Associates, a network of international economists that study developmental economics. She's co-authored or edited 19 books. I could go on and on. The CV outstrips any that I have seen in recent memory. And we were just talking, Jyoti, about what happened post-pandemic, that these incredibly large 4 to 5 major agribusiness companies in the United States basically kept prices artificially inflated. A word for it would be price gouging. Folks in the United States certainly saw that. People are still angry about this. But you are saying it wasn't just the large agribusinesses. And I'll make a note for everyone. If you think this is just a recent phenomena, I suggest that you check out the Archer Daniels Midland price fixing scheme, which was explicit and done internationally about 20, 25 years ago. So go check that out. It's happening again. But you were talking about this intersection between these agribusiness and the financial sector.
Yes. So really what happened is that agribusiness raises its prices, but also finance is entering the global commodity markets. And there's this thing called the futures market, where you basically predict a price in the future. So you can buy a futures at a higher price, which kind of makes you everyone think that you anticipate a higher price. What happened is that financial companies entered the commodity futures market in a big way and bought long and really pushed up the price. So when the futures price goes up, finally the spot market responds as well. So the current prices go up. And this went on for about 8 months until prices were double what they had been pre-war. But obviously, there was no real change in demand or supply, so they would have to come down, and they did. So mind you, in that period, they're raking in the profits. Like, these big companies made the biggest profits in their history in that period. So did a lot of the companies that were doing this futures market stuff, the financial companies. Then prices come down again. So by the end of that period, at the end of 2023, you're back where you were before the start of the Ukraine war. Right. So some people said, fine, OK, prices went up for a while, but they've come down again. So why are you worried? You were worried because, of course, first of all, it did affect people while it happened. But in most of the world, when the prices came down globally, they didn't come down for the people in those countries. So, you know, the Food and Agriculture Organization, they have a food price index that came down by more than 12% in that period, between September 2022 and September 2023. But prices in low and middle income countries continue to increase by 10%, 15%. In low income countries, the poorest countries of the world, they went up by 30% food prices in a period when global prices were falling. So why was that happening? Because their currencies were depreciating. And why were their currencies depreciating? Because they were losing all this capital that was coming back to the US. Interest rates are going up in the US, right. There's tightening in Europe. And so all this capital comes back. These countries, their currencies collapse. They experience depreciation of 20%, 30%, 40%. So even the imported food is much, much more expensive.
It's stunning. There were countries that, due to their currency collapsing, as well as this profiteering, this war and pandemic profiteering, this price gouging, they simply could not import enough food to feed their country. Again, folks, we could solve world hunger. It is a solvable problem. And yet world hunger has gotten worse. And we see that even here in the United States, one of the richest countries in the world, we still have millions of children that are food insecure every day. I wanted to give you an opportunity to also address Big Pharma, because we see some of these also incredibly pernicious patterns in this industry as well.
You know, Big Pharma is the other really big, I would say, if you had to identify a few villains globally, it's out there, I'm sorry to say. Yet it's always presented as the one that's giving us these wonderful scientific breakthroughs. And so we should all be grateful because they're giving us all these new medicines, and where would we be without them? So here's the thing. One of the big problems with Big Pharma is that it benefits from this weird thing called intellectual property rights. Mm-hmm. So what's that? That's basically the privatization of knowledge. It's basically saying I can take something and say it's my invention, or I can buy it up from somebody else and control it. And I will not give you access to the information that you need, the knowledge that you need to produce it yourself. So it's like creating a monopoly. And this is something that has become particularly widespread globally in the last 20 years after the WTO had an agreement on intellectual property. It's called TRIPS, the Trade-Related Intellectual Property Rights Agreement. What did that do? That allowed all these companies to hold on to their knowledge, and all across the world, they would actually prevent other companies from becoming competitors and reducing the price. So Big Pharma, we saw this so much during COVID. Now, remember that we actually did a great job globally in terms of producing vaccines very quickly. This is the fastest ever that vaccines have been produced. So that's absolutely true. But why was it so fast? Because governments put huge subsidies to these companies. The US government alone gave $12 billion to just six companies. And in Europe as well, there were big subsidies given, mostly using public research that had already been done in universities and national science foundations, and adding a little bit, you know, that last mile.
Yes.
So all the R&D was covered. It was paid for by taxpayers, right? Yet, once you develop the vaccine, then the government helps you out by giving you very fast track clearance and approval because you need the vaccines, mm-hmm. reduces the time you need to do the clinical tests, does all of that. And then it says you can price it at whatever you want, and you don't have to share this knowledge or technology.
It's really stunning. I'm going to cite from the most recent Oxfam report we discussed just a couple of days ago, quote, sharply increasing billionaire wealth and rising corporate and monopoly power are deeply connected. The profits of mega corporations are in turn used to benefit shareholders at the expense of workers and ordinary people. Folks, my very special guest this half hour has been Jyoti Ghosh.
Thanks for listening to Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money, a joint production of Civic Media and the Patriotic Millionaires. For more information, go to patrioticmillionaires.org and be sure to tell your friends. The Patriotic Millionaires buy advertising across a number of Civic Media stations.